I mean, yes, they are refugee crises, but that makes the refugee into the problem. What is actually the problem? Are they the result of a problem, or are they the problem? They're the result of a problem.
You're listening to Seeking Refuge, a podcast sharing the human stories of refugees. Our guest for today is Dr. Sarah Waheed, an assistant professor at the University of South Carolina and specialist of South Asian history. Her courses focus on medieval, early modern, and modern South Asia. She sat down with Claire and Anusha to discuss the current geopolitical situation in Pakistan and how it affects Afghani refugees seeking refuge in Pakistan. Your hosts for today are Claire Mattis and Anusha Ghosh.
Welcome, Dr. Waheed, to the Seeking Refuge podcast. Today, we'll be talking about the political conditions in Pakistan for displaced persons and refugees and how that relates specifically to Afghan refugees. So if you wouldn't mind first starting and just give us a brief introduction just to who you are, what your background is in these topics.
Okay, so my name is Sarah Waheed, and I am a history professor studying South Asian history and politics from effectively from the medieval period into the present. And those are the courses I teach, are largely around South Asia and largely around global history. But more specifically, my research takes a look at the first book I wrote, looks at sort of the question of censorship in colonial India, as well as in post-colonial Pakistan. And I'm currently writing a book about sort of 400 years into the past about a warrior queen from India. When it comes to the question of Pakistan in particular, I have been traveling to India as well as Pakistan since I was about 15 or so. And I've been to both countries, which is not easy to do. And that's largely because of my first world passport privileges. Although in more contemporary times, I think those privileges are under great threat because if you travel to India, especially as a Muslim, or rather if you travel to Pakistan and then try to travel to India, it's very, very difficult now, if not impossible. So my husband is Pakistani and my family is originally from India. They are from the southern India, from a place called Hyderabad, which was a Muslim-ruled princely state up until 1948, when the Indian state annexed the princely state of Hyderabad. And my connections, you know, a lot of times South Asians who are nationalists, right, like to identify either India or Pakistan as a kind of national category to which they adhere. And I resist that completely. So when I talk about my background, and I mean, not only in terms of my education, which I had largely in the United States, I grew up in Saudi Arabia, which enabled me to travel to India and Pakistan as a child fairly regularly. I spent all my summers and winters and, you know, spring, almost a third of the year in India. And of course, like I said, traveled to Pakistan as well. My parents, you know, even though my mother and father both grew up in India, and my father at one point in the 1960s immigrated to India, or rather to Pakistan. He left India for Pakistan for various reasons, both having to do with his politics, the political condition in India at the time, as well as having to do with economic questions about getting a job. He lived in Pakistan for about 4 to 5 years, after which he traveled immigrated to Canada, which is where I was born. Though I said, like I said, I wasn't raised there. I was raised in Saudi Arabia. I went to American international schools and grew up with a fairly diverse coterie of not just South Asians, but people from all around the world, like the Middle East and from lots of different other countries, Canada, UK, you know, the Australia, as well as India, Pakistan. You know, I had Jordanian, Palestinian, Pakistani, Indian, Egyptian friends growing up. And so I think that all of that combined gives me perspective, I think, on questions having to do with migration, travel, but also this question of what it means to be stateless. And for me, you know, I'm not somebody who's had that experience of being stateless in the way of obviously a refugee has had, but I can identify in so much as having grown up in various parts of the world and the kinds of encounters I've had and the people I've met, both sort of at an experiential level, you know, sort of talking to people and learning about their conditions at the most precarious level. levels in terms of their conditions, as well as sort of thinking more about sort of how we study this and understand this historically, politically, and socially.
Oh, that's amazing. That's definitely a diverse and unique, I feel like, childhood, at least from what I have experienced. So that's going to provide a great, interesting perspective for sure. So, you know, with your knowledge of also, you know, your studies, as well as your experience being in Pakistan, can you describe kind of the political state of the country currently, not just regarding refugees, but yeah, just the general state of the nation?
Yeah, the general condition in Pakistan is really quite abysmal insofar as when you think about democracy, when you think about the economic conditions of peoples. I think right now, economically, in Pakistan is perhaps at its lowest point with regards sort of what's happening with, you know, like I said, the economic condition is at its lowest poorest point than it has been for a long time, or if indeed ever, with the rise of sort of like when you think about things like inflation, the cost of living. And we have to bear in mind that this is partly the result of a long history of how Pakistan has been tied up in the war economy for so long. And that has to do with the fact that Pakistan has been ruled for much of its history by the military. Now, that's not to say that it hasn't had elections. It has. Of course, in India, elections are held regularly every 5 years. In Pakistan, elections have been suspended, you know, renegotiated, put on pause throughout a series of military dictatorships. And really the control of Pakistan's politics and economy, and in fact, the very, like the fabric of social life is so determined, in fact, so overdetermined by the military that it's hard to do any kind of analysis without looking to that first, right? More recently, there has been elections as of February 8th, right? So in recent years, the prime minister of Pakistan was Imran Khan, who was a former cricket star and fairly well-known entity globally, really. I mean, you know, he hobnobbed with British royal family. He's sort of been with the rich and famous for a really long time, really like a sort of heartthrob in India and in Pakistan as his tenure as a cricket star. But he came to power as part of the Tehreek-e-Insaf party. The party was called the Party of Justice, but basically establishes this political party several years ago, at which he becomes at its helm. And in recent years has drawn considerable popular support from the middle class, right? And, you know, it's really important to also consider that Imran Khan, though he may be very, very popular in the Pakistani diaspora here by Pakistani Americans, he's very popular in Pakistan. However, you know, and he's, of course, very popular in Pakistan, too. This is not to suggest he's not, but that there's, you can see a lot more in terms of sort of polarization, if you will, between those who support the erstwhile. So there's always been a civil government and a military government, right? But of course, like I said, it's usually the military who really has the real political power and control. Nonetheless, the civil sort of government that had been formed for a long time, it was led by the PPP, the Pakistan People's Party, and that was the sort of dynastic politics of the Bhuttos, right? So the Bhutto family, like you can think of the, you know, Gandhi family, and this is not Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi. This is sort of Indira Gandhi, who's the daughter of the first prime minister of India, and then her children and her grandchildren, and now what you're seeing today, right? I mean, almost her great-grandchildren coming to the fore, or rather her grandchildren coming to the fore in the Indian National Congress. In Pakistan, similarly, you've had dynastic family politics when it comes to the Bhuttos with the PPP, Pakistan People's Party. There has been in recent years a lot of critique by the Pakistani middle class about the corruption. I mean, Pakistan has very sort of high levels of corruption, and both in terms of its politics and everyday life. And, you know, in terms of seeing the PPP as no longer a viable political entity that can truly lead and guide the people. So amongst the middle class, given that disillusionment with a lot of the political parties, they threw their weight behind Imran Khan, not only with regards to that, but, you know, Imran Khan is, he's fairly center-right. He's not sort of, you know, a liberal by any stretch of the imagination. And, you know, the parliament, he called for the parliament of Pakistan to be dissolved. This is partly why he was taken up on these charges. And of course, the way in which the military has cracked down on the middle class supporters, as well as on Imran Khan himself, because he was in jailed. I mean, in spite of the fact that he was in jailed, his wife was in jail also, he's been arrested, in spite of the fact that his political party couldn't use those slogans, you know, for their party and so on and so forth. Nonetheless, his party won the most substantial share of the votes during the last election cycle. All that said and done, the conditions for everyday people in Pakistan are abysmal. As I said, the vast majority of 170 million Pakistanis, if not more, perhaps closer now to 200 million Pakistanis, live in atrocious conditions. I mean, if you think about sort of just the sort of the vast majority of the people of Pakistan are poor. Many of them are in the rural sector, farmers whose lands have frequently been the target of dramatic forms of really land theft, both sort of from loan sharks, as well as, of course, by the military itself that will establish and build and take land to do with it what it will. Of course, these things depend on where in Pakistan you're talking about it. Like if you're talking about Karachi, which is a major economic center of the country, versus sort of Islamabad, which is the political kind of, you know, capital, it's the capital of the country. Of course, these conditions vary, but nonetheless, overall, the conditions in Pakistan are economically atrocious. As I mentioned, this is all linked up also to the war economy, because especially in more recent years, if you look at Pakistan's role in the so-called global war on terror, as it functioned kind of like a, it continues to function as a rentier state, I mean, a client state during the global war on terror by the United States. And recall that the United States also supported some of the most abhorrent military dictators in Pakistan, like General Zia-ul-Haq, who ruled for 11 years between 1977 and 1989 or thereabouts, and who really kind of catapulted Pakistan into this Islamicizing nation. That was the kind of ethos he was promoting through policy as well, which had very dangerous consequences for women and for minorities. But the, like I said, the war economy, given the most recent sort of end to the global war on terror, and I put that in quotation marks, that has not ended. The U.S. withdrew from Afghanistan, but these wars that were spawned in the aftermath of 9/11 have catapulted in local, regional, international armed conflicts that have really created what we are now seeing today, all kinds of refugee crises and internally displaced persons. So that's kind of the overall, I would say, a brief kind of introduction to the context of Pakistan today and its recent history.
Absolutely. Thank you. That's a great introduction, I think, and gives a lot of context. And that's kind of led me to my next question, got me thinking about, you're talking about, you know, the state of just the economic state of life of people in Pakistan right now. How does, do you know if that impacts the way the people view these incoming refugees or displaced persons? And, you know, what's that view? Because this is obviously comparing to in the United States and other Western countries that the economy plays a big role in how people view immigrants. Mm-hmm. So can you tell me more about that, if that has any relation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to touch on this economic question in just a minute, but I want to talk specifically about Afghanistan, and that refugees from Afghanistan have been coming into Pakistan and Iran. I mean, Pakistan and Iran have been the largest population, we have seen the largest population of Afghan refugees out of any other country in the world. Okay, so that's the first important point. And that has to do both the fact that there's sort of border regions and also proximity, but it also has to do with these political and economic sort of histories. And really, Afghanistan is a country, right, that has had some form of conflict, war, you know, for over 40 years now, perhaps even actually closer to now half a century. If you think about the ways in which it was at the grounds over which, right, I mean, the Cold War, if you look at sort of the history of the Cold War, and you look at the ways in which the Soviet Union and the United States were the superpowers who were fighting it out, where did they fight it out? It was not in the United States where the theater of war occurred, right? It was in places like Vietnam, in places like Afghanistan. And there you had the emergence initially of all kinds of fighters who were protected and enabled by the United States to fight against Soviet incursions into Afghanistan, right?
those out of that kind of came this, civil war. There was a civil war that took place where various different groupings, political groupings in Afghanistan, they were fighting with each other, contending over power. And then, of course, you have the rise of the Taliban, right, which is a modern phenomenon, has nothing to do with any kind of pre-modern medieval past, but the rise of the Taliban, which then sort of resulted in a kind of new forms of oppression for the peoples of Afghanistan, right? And then at the heels of that, you have, of course, not just US proxy wars, but post 9/11, a kind of new engagement with and against Afghanistan, right? So we've been seeing refugees. I wrote about this many years ago when I was actually your age. It like just recently graduated from college about Afghan refugees in Pakistan at that time. You can imagine that this has been an ongoing problem. When it comes to economic condition in Pakistan today, like I said, it's atrocious. I think we have to understand that the way that economic condition is manipulated by the political establishment to then reinforce and in fact draw from and use the existing racism against Afghans, because there's a lot of anti-Afghan racism, both in Pakistan as well as Iran. In Pakistan, that anti-Afghan racism typically now takes the people from Afghanistan are viewed as sort of terrorists in the making. They're viewed as very threatening and violent and so on and so forth, right? I mean, these are people who have some of the most oppressive conditions, living conditions in Pakistan. Okay, they're stateless insofar as even if they have an ID card, going back to Afghanistan is not an option for them. And you have now generations of Afghan refugees living in Pakistan who have known nothing but Pakistan, right? So they have not lived in Afghanistan, and they are also being forced out of the country. So it's not just the economic condition alone. It's the way the economic condition is exploited by the political establishment and how there is no accountability by the political establishment, given the rampant levels of corruption, given the rampant, I mean, the most corrupt institution in Pakistan is the military by far. And now you have these added layers of all kinds of crises that were generated out of the withdrawal from Afghanistan of the United States, which has just engendered new levels of crises with regards to refugee and internally displaced people. So it's really sort of the ways in which economics is manipulated politically so that the political leadership, the elites, the political elites can then, who control, of course, much of the media and much of sort of the way people get their information, can then make a case and justify this atrocious, I mean, something like 850,000, almost 1 million, okay? So 850,000 Afghan refugees are being forced out of Pakistan. And we saw the first phase of that go down in the fall of this 2023, in October, November, or I believe it started in late October or early November, rather. And now you're seeing the second phase, which is set to go into motion by April 15th. So yes, the economic conditions are dire, but it's the way that that is manipulated by the political elite to justify all kinds of oppressive and really policies that would render a stateless people even more in dire straits and impoverished.
That's a great point. I think you worded that really well, because it's hard to describe, you know, an economic issue being, you know, being manipulated, but that's like, I think the best way to say that. So in relation to that, they announced the deportations in like early October and began them near the end of October. How is this going to change through April? Can you describe the second, you know, phase of this?
Yeah, what we saw in the fall was rampant abuses. And these human rights abuses have been very well documented by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and other human rights organizations. You also now have people who are Afghan who are being deported, of Afghan ethnicity who are being deported, who have valid visas. So it's not as though they are without papers. So it's not just after people without papers, but Afghans who have papers, who have valid visas, or who have residency permits, right? And you've seen that first phase in October and November, not just that they were being expelled from the country, and in a very rapid and very sort of extreme kind of measures being taken, but they were robbed and they were charged for their expulsion. I mean, they were charged money to be expelled. So they were asked, like demanded of them money to various offices of the state in order for them to be expelled. So can you imagine? So it's not just that they're being kicked out, they're having to pay for their being kicked out. I mean, it's really atrocious.
No, that's absolutely insane. I was reading about that actually, because Pakistan is not a part of the 1951 convention or the 1967 protocol. So I guess all of the, in that case, I don't know if there's any newer forms of protection. Obviously not if they're being charged, but are there groups in Pakistan who are, you know, advocating for that? What's the complexities of that, I guess?
You know, in more recent years, we have seen in Pakistan any number of activist groups, there have been long-standing human rights struggles in Pakistan, but you are seeing more of them gaining traction. And so far as, I'll give you an example, like you see in, because the Pakistani military, it has controlled territories that were not fully under the Pakistan control when the British left, right? So there are border regions like Waziristan is not a border region, but it's close, right? Closer to in the northern areas. These regions have been expected to be brought to heel by the Pakistani military, right? So I suppose, you know, when we think about these conventions and these laws, I'm not really sure to what extent those laws exist past being on the books or if they exist, in fact, you know, at all. But when it comes to human rights struggles, what we are seeing are, yes, there are people in Pakistan who have questioned this. There are, you know, activists. I mean, we have seen in Pakistan a very strong feminist spring effectively take place in the past few years, these international on Women's Day, these marches, you know, you have seen large numbers of people, you know, protesting in Balochistan, which has been a region that has been under real serious, I mean, basically a form of military occupation by Pakistan. They're not even recognized. Their basic human or democratic rights are not recognized. Now, when it comes to Afghans, because they're also Pashtun and then they speak Pashto and that language has been now associated with the Taliban and the ways in which the kind of racism unfolds, right? So there are some people who are speaking out, but largely anti-Afghan racism is very widely accepted in Pakistan. And so, yes, you do have human rights groups speaking out. So let me give you an example. You have a figure like Manzoor Pashteen, and he is at the helm of TPP, But this is basically a struggle amongst Pashtuns within Pakistan who have, I mean, because there's Pashtuns in Pakistan and there's Pashtuns obviously in Afghanistan. And the Pashtun people in Pakistan have faced the wrath of the state. I mean, the way in which the military has come in there and leveled entire villages, kidnapped people, abducted people, tortured Pashtun people. And so in recent years, you've seen this movement led by Manzoor Pashteen, who was actually recently arrested. Unfortunately, he was arrested, but you know, he was effectively running a human rights struggle. He was asking for very basic things. Take out the mines. There are mines that have been planted in regions where a lot of Pashtuns live. Remove those mines, right? Return people who've been forcibly abducted by the state. Do not carry out forcible abductions. All these kinds of demands, right? Which are sort of the bare minimum in terms of human rights, right? So there are groups who've been speaking out, but someone like Manzoor Pashteen, when he spoke out because he's Pashtun and because there's so much anti-Pashtun racism, the way he is depicted within Pakistan, because the Pakistani military, you know, runs so much of its own propaganda campaigns through social media and through elsewhere. I mean, there's so many fake pages that are fake Facebook pages, for example, or other social media accounts that supposedly go under some ordinary citizen's name, but actually is Pakistani military propaganda. And they have come after Manzoor Pashteen, you know, calling him a terrorist and so on and so forth. And so that way in which the terrorist and the Pashtun has been completely, you know, same exact person, that is very deeply ingrained in the Pakistani national psyche. And it's very problematic. I mean, for example, I'll give you an example. My husband, he is from a Pashtun background. I mean, he's Urdu speaking. Ethnically, he's Pashtun. But, you know, when he has a beard and he wears a hat that is called pakol, which you see in many regions of where Pashtuns live in Pakistan and elsewhere too. And in places like very, you know, urban Pakistan, he's been stopped by the police. He's been, you know, the kind of stop and frisk, right? So that kind of thing happens in Pakistan. Now, if you are not aware, like, for example, in the United States, you have anti-Black racism, right? You know, what you'll see in Pakistan is, so you can have racism without that other, the other person being darker than you, because of course, Afghans are more fair skinned than many Punjabi Pakistanis, right? So it's really not about literally the color of your skin, but it's about the kind of ethno-racist, you know, preponderance of that. Nonetheless, yes, you have seen people speaking out, but those voices are oftentimes squashed, or they're not as heard. I mean, Arundhati Roy says it really brilliantly. There's no such thing as the voiceless. They're only the deliberately misheard, the deliberately misunderstood. And that's what you see. So when people do speak up in Pakistan for the rights of these Afghan refugees, you know, this is something that's very frequently, you know, squashed and or not seen as an important issue. I mean, it's just atrocious. I mean, when I was in Pakistan many years ago, and this is putting me up about round in the 2000, no, actually, this is like late 1990s. I saw, we stopped at the side of the road because our car broke down. This is between Islamabad and sort of, we were off to those rural areas. And our car broke down and I saw on the side of the road, this very deep kind of area. And I saw children running there. I said, what's going on there? And it's where basically laborers are making bricks out of, you know, they're putting them in the heat and on the fire and they're making those bricks. Who is doing that work? Children, the age of some 6, 7 years old, running around practically barefoot or maybe with some slippers in hot sand, jumping over these flames, putting in these bricks, taking them out. That's who is subsidizing Pakistan. I mean, when you look at South Asia overall and you look at who is actually subsidizing the food, it's the poor, it's the farmers, it's the refugees. And in Pakistan, the conditions of Afghan refugees is just, I mean, I don't even know. There's no words I can really say without saying, again, atrocious and just really despicable. And like I said, when people do speak out, it seems to me that, as far as I am aware, that those voices are oftentimes quelled.
I like that you use the phrase deliberately misheard. I'm going to start using that because that's an excellent description of kind of, you know, all activism, really. But I think that, yeah, that explains that really well, because I was looking into it and didn't see much humanitarian, but I figured it's just not, you know, shared as often. So then I guess you answer all my questions as you're talking, which is great. But I have been thinking about what is the international community's role in this, specifically the West, which you've explained, but if you could talk about really recently, you know, this year, if like, what's the role of the West in the acceptance of Afghan refugees? Because I know, you know, the United States hasn't taken that many. And, you know, how is this affected in Pakistan?
Right. So we've seen that the United States has been very reluctant, if even reluctant is the word, if not sort of outright against expanding and or making possible asylum, even sort of, I know that there were Afghans who applied for asylum after the United States withdrew from Afghanistan. But again, you know, if you look at the vetting processes in the United States, which are very, very strict, even the people who are vetted, right, there's so much resistance against, there's already a kind of complex set of immigration debates going on in this country, but a lot of it's rooted in just frankly racism and a lot of anti, quote unquote, anti-migrant, right? I mean, we see these crises as migrant crises, refugee crises. We never see them as racism crises. We never see them or talk about them as colonialism crises or crises born out of the ways in which the global North and largely, yes, these Western countries have played a role both historically, but also in more contemporary times, politically and economically. Now, I believe we are at a critical juncture. When we talk about the international community, who do we mean? Do we mean the entire United Nations? Do we mean the Security Council? Right? Who are we talking about when it comes to the international community? Because that term is oftentimes used, but then what do we mean by that? But I do think we're at a very, very critical juncture right now, historically, especially with US-funded genocide in Palestine, right? And so we are at a critical historical juncture. We are at a moment where so much of the facade of the West standing up as a being a harbinger of human rights has completely fallen apart. Right? Because the United States at this present moment is funding, enabling, complicit in, I mean, involved in, really orchestrating together with Israel, the genocide of Palestinian people. And what has happened as a result of this, right, in terms of the ways in which, not just in terms of U.S. standing in the world and how people around the world view the United States, which was already fairly negative for various, like I said, economic, political reasons and reasons of war. I mean, so much of that has been going on in terms of just arms trade alone, right, various allies of the United States. But I mean, if you think about what this then, the message it gives to other state actors around the world, which is that it just really doesn't matter. None of these sort of human rights, none of these conventions really just don't matter. It's really sort of what, it's kind of like the gloves are off. People can do what they will. Now, I also have a critique of the United Nations. I have a critique of these bodies, actually, which are rendered so, you know, like it's, the old joke goes, if you ever feel useless, just remember the UN exists. Right. So, you know, they were rendered so completely inept, if not in some instances, part of the problem, right? Because of the ways in which various sort of member states have also, especially those, again, very powerful European states, and of course, the United States, have an outsized role within this international community, right? So, I mean, I think it's important to recognize that when now, I mean, this is going to be a growing critique. Anytime the United States, and indeed any of these European countries involved and complicit in the genocide of Palestinians, anytime they bring up human rights issues in places like Pakistan, in places like, I don't know, Egypt, in any other part of the global South, particularly in the Middle East and also in South Asia, the response is going to be, you have no creds to tell us what is human rights. And I mean, that critique has been something that has been done before, and we've heard that before, but that's only going to further be used to then justify if the most powerful countries in the world who claim to be harbingers of justice, peace, human rights, right, all over the world, have just completely thrown that out the window, then what, and on what moral grounds can a country like the United States critique Pakistan for its mass deportation of Afghan refugees and migrants, when it also is contending with its own issues in the United States, with sort of especially on the right, right, with Donald Trump, but not just him. I mean, you go look at sort of the statistics of migrants and the mass deportations that happened under Obama. You know, this is something that has been in the making for a very long time. But when you actually go and look at that, right, these crises, I think we really need to call them for what they are. They're not necessarily, I mean, yes, they are refugee crises, but that makes the refugee into the problem. What is actually the problem? Are they the result of a problem or are they the problem? They're the result of a problem, right? And the problems are magnanimous, and they have to do with, frankly speaking, political and economic interests of the elite defending the most egregious human rights violations on the basis of what? On the basis of what? Some loyalty to your state and your political leadership over and above a unified kind of understanding of human rights. So that's, I mean, there's so much at stake.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent take on the United States as well. I think that's something that I have heard even now, you know, just critiques on the United States, and will definitely get worse for sure. I think you answered all of my questions really well. Anusha, do you have anything you'd like to add or any questions you'd like to ask?
I just want to say this has been an incredible interview. And I just kept on thinking about, like, you know, this underlying theme of xenophobia, yes, and hate towards neighbors. Like, this is completely a different topic, but like I kept thinking about, like, you know, the recent policy that Modi passed, excluding Muslim people who are located in India from, yes, gaining citizenship rights. And it's interesting, like, you know, how this kind of like line of xenophobia kind of carries across nation lines, even if it is different groups of people.
Yes, yes. So it's sort of a combination, on the one hand, of a virulent form of global Islamophobia we're seeing, combined with nationalist politics, which have often or almost always rendered a group, whatever that group may be or groups may be, as outside of the majoritarian and or sort of ideal citizen subject, combined with global economic forms just catastrophes, not to mention the climate catastrophe, and really corrupt and as well as, you know, self-serving political elite and increasing levels of authoritarianism all over the world. And so what we've seen with Modi, for example, he was the first of these that got elected, first of these very sort of authoritarian in this wave from 2014, right? 2014, he was elected 2 years before Donald Trump was elected in the United States. And, you know, there's a whole history there that I'm happy to discuss, but perhaps it's not directly relevant here. But we are seeing sort of so many levels and confluences, particularly in the regions I'm interested in, South Asia and the Middle East. We're seeing the confluence of so many of these crises emerging together. And I mean, we have only hope, but, you know, there are these crises are also generating amongst young people renewed interest in the policies of their governments and the conditions, economic, political, and social, by which they're made possible, and how young people I've seen all over the world, not just in the United States, but in India, elsewhere, who are really leading movements for change and are really struggling to be heard themselves, but are nonetheless very much committed to the question of human rights and the question of, you know, what that means with regards to these histories. There's a much more greater awareness amongst young people, perhaps, about these histories of colonialism and racism that fuels these kinds of human rights abuses.
Absolutely. I think that's a great point. And I'm really excited. I think this is one of our, we've had other episodes talking about colonialism and its role in the refugee, or as you're saying, the refugee crisis that has placed the blame on refugees. So I'm really excited to kind of post this. I think it'll be a refreshing episode for us.
Thank you so much for doing this. And so your podcast is amazing. So I'm really excited to listen to this one, but I've listened to them. They're great.
Oh, good. Awesome. I'm so glad. Well, again, yeah, we really appreciate it. So thank you so much. And I'll see you in class.
Okay. All right. You take care. Thank you so much, Claire. Thank you, Anusha. Bye. Take care. Bye.
That was Dr. Sarah Waheed, a South Asian history scholar, sharing her knowledge about and experience in Pakistan and how it relates to the climate for refugees. We also immensely appreciated her insight into the rhetoric used to discuss refugees and the greater systems and structures that have led to the so-called refugee crises. To learn more about Dr. Waheed's work and the courses she teaches, you can visit the University of South Carolina's Department of History website and find her in the directory. If you liked this episode, be sure to like, subscribe, rate, and review us in the comments below. If you'd like to get in touch with us, email us at seekingrefugepodcast@gmail.com or at our University of South Carolina email address, sosrpa@mailbox.sc.edu. You can find us on social media at Refuge Podcast on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook. This show is produced by undergraduate students at the University of South Carolina. Your hosts for this week were Claire Mattis and Anusha Ghosh. This episode was edited by me, Diana Clark, and produced by Molly Mims. Our executive producers are Claire Mattis and Victoria Halsey. As always, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you in the next one.